once you've, I think when you don't know what you want to do, you should stay in academia, or you should stay in a space that allows you to do 5 projects and explore different ideas. But the moment that there is a thing that gets you out of bed every day of the week, that makes you not fall asleep because you're so excited about it, you should leave academia right now. And you should, especially when you have an idea how you can turn that into something that is financially sustainable. Yeah. The private sector allows you to focus on one thing. And when you can focus and when you don't want to focus, it's not the right place. But if you want to focus and you want to dedicate yourself to one thing, it's the best place. That's something I learned over the last couple of months, and when I contrast that to the attitude I had while I was still in academia.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the DSci podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Niklas Rintorf. Niklas is a physician scientist and a founder of LabDAO, a community of life scientists who collaborate to increase the accessibility of life science tools, both in Agile Lab and Wet Lab. Niklas and I talk about bottlenecks within DSci, the underrated aspects of academia, as well as the misconceptions between both the public and private sectors. For this and much more, enjoy listening to our conversation. So, Niklas, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
So to start off, could you introduce what LabDAO is doing on a high level? What's its role in the kind of life science field? And perhaps you could extend that question to decentralized science as well.
Yeah, so LabDAO is gathered around the idea of the first principle that there should be scientific organizations that live completely online. When we look at various branches of life sciences, more and more of them are driven by computation and driven by computational scientists that contribute to them. And computational scientists should be able to work from anywhere. And that was really one of the initial ideas that led to LabDAO. Now, when we take one step further and we ask, well, how could you build a scientific organization that is completely online? The potential question that comes up is, well, how do you access any infrastructure to run compute, but also to run experiments, to actually run inquiries against the natural world? And that's a real blocker to have fully online scientific organizations. So what we're building is an exchange protocol where scientists can offer some access laboratory resources or tools that they have, or computational resources that they have, and also commercial labs join that network. And it's pretty exciting, actually. Last week, we sort of for the first time announced Plex, which is our lightweight client that only can right now run distributed compute and is built on top of Bacalao, and actually is one first step into that direction, which I believe will eventually turn into a scientific organization that's completely online.
Great. Perhaps right away, ask the obvious question, why 100% online? What's the strong case for that in the first place?
Yes, that's a really good question. Like, why bother doing science online? I think there is one data-driven argument for it, that is utility maximizing or progress maximizing, and then there's a normative argument for it. And let's start with just the pure data first. There is evidence showing that smaller scientific teams have more disruptive ideas. And that is not the case for decentralization per se on the internet, but also that remote teams, so teams where the co-authors are not in the same city, they tend to have more disruptive patents. And there are various ways in which you can measure the degree of disruptiveness of a patent or a publication. But according to the metrics used in these studies, and we'll have to put them into the show notes, there is an association between the degree of distribution of a scientific team and their disruptiveness of the invention. And what's pretty cool, actually, on that note, is that trend has changed over time. So in the 80s, a team that was remote was actually less disruptive. And you can actually see over the last couple of years, I think in that study they binned it into 10-year groups. You could see over like 10-year intervals, actually science gets more disruptive. Like in the 90s or early 2000s, a team that was remote was about as creative as a team that was local. And now we're actually entering a time with Zoom calls and Discords and GitHub where a remote team is actually more creative. So that's one. That's like, this is just good for science and good for human progress. Now there's the second argument, which is normative. Who do you want to participate in the scientific process? Who do you want to be able to capture the fruits of like labor and invention? And I fundamentally believe that wealth that is created through creativity and innovation and technological progress, that should not be constrained to national borders. I think there is a place for organizations that live completely online, that are governed through smart contracts to the extent that it can be done. And right now we're not far enough. But that basically that everybody participate in that invention process, irrespective of whether they're based on the Indian subcontinent, on the African continent, Europe, America, South America, China, Japan. As long as you have an internet connection and you're standing for the free world, like a free world, then you should be able to participate in science, and you should be able to invent.
Yeah. So I'm not sure whether you're actually at that stage yet, but what would IP look like in a world in which there's not really like an institution to like put you down into like a national boundary? Who like actually owns the research? If you have like a team of 20 different nationalities all working together, have you thought about this at least, even if it's not in place yet?
Yeah, absolutely. We've thought about it. And I think we have to be honest that there is not an easy answer. And there's a reason why we have public institutions. And there's a reason why countries with strong public institutions, I think some economists refer to them as the seven eyes. Those are nations that have strong institutions. The United States, Germany, are some of them. There's a reason why countries that have strong institutions are more innovative. There's some research showing that, for example, if inventors have the ability to seek, some Pitagorean economists call it innovation rents. So if you're able to protect your invention, and if the market in which you're operating allows you to protect your innovation, there's actually an increased tendency to invent. So we need some form of like legitimacy, right? So there needs to be some form of legitimacy for inventors, and inventors need to be able to protect their IP. And because we don't have a clear answer yet how we could do this in a sort of global institutional context or organizational context, we're going to be relying on national institutions for now. Okay, so that's sort of short term. Now, long term, let's speculate about how this could look like in a sort of international context. Well, the web, I think, gives us a couple lessons around what you could call bragging rights in sort of the cultural sphere. So everybody can, for example, copy paste a Bored Ape Yacht Club NFT or a punk, and sort of display that. But there is some culture online that has emerged where that is frowned upon, and I think to some extent, Yuga Labs, sometimes the creators of those NFTs, they actually also enforce that you are only able to display that token when you actually hold it, and that is all private. That is all sort of civil law, private. This could all be private arbitration law that you don't need to necessarily have a one single international entity sort of being at the other side of this. That's one thought. And then on top of that, if you are an inventor and you've come up with something, and I'm an investor, and I need to now make a decision whether I fund your project, if you just broadcast it through the internet that you just came up with that, and you were the first to come up with that, like, where should I invest? Like, am I going to invest with the person that looked at it and said, now I can build a company based on that technology? Or am I going to invest in the person that came up with the invention and says, now I want to build a company and take it one step further? Now, very likely you're going to invest in the project that's sort of been gathering around the person that actually initially invented it. So I think efficiency in the capital markets might actually create legitimacy around invention that gets us to a point where we might not even need to really protect that anymore in sort of a defensive way.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I suppose as the products get more complex, like we're talking about mainly stuff in the hard sciences right now.
Right.
The like expertise of actually having worked like in a lab on a project and like understanding kind of technicalities. That seems very hard to kind of just like take away and like run with if you have no kind of like similar context.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Like if you post on Twitter that you've invented something and the code is open source, and it's really interesting, and you want to turn into a company, and there might be a competitor company coming up, I think the market is going to decide, and most of the time it's going to side with the inventor and fund their project.
It's interesting. Have you seen any projects, or like, are there any research papers kind of being written about that? Like, how does it actually work out if more stuff is open sourced? Is the market kind of on the side of the inventors most of the time?
This is a good question. I actually have not seen any research, or I haven't sufficiently searched for research that looks at open source as one particular example. So I could only answer with anecdotes. I think there are more and more businesses coming out that have an open source core. And oftentimes it's sort of things go in conjunction, like they open source a piece of the action. And then everybody that wants to learn more already knows in the subtext that there is a company coming around this. And I think the same will hopefully be true with open source biology soon as well.
Yeah. It might make interesting research in the future. What do you wish you would have known before starting LabDAO so far?
Ooh, so many things. I guess the first thing would be that even though it's Web3, and even though you come in with, you could say, some perhaps more ideological motivations, and like you actually want to change, you're a part of the movement and you want to change the trajectory of society, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it still comes down to like basics, startup lessons and rules. Like, you are starting something new, you are the founder, you need to go through a lot of the trials and tribulations and jump through a lot of the hoops that like it's, a lot of founders have had to go through before you, so you better don't try to reinvent every wheel. Ideally, you try to do actually everything just the same way, and you just change that one variable that you believe in most of the time.
Yeah. So have those realizations then changed anything about how you structure LabDAO? Like, how have you kind of taken the, you know, listen to everything, but changed the one variable that you are ideologically supportive of?
Yeah, I think.
How's that been incorporated?
I think the way that we LabDAO has matured as a project is in a way in which we are an open source community, and at the core, it looks a lot like a company. So there's a team that's working full time. We have regular check-ins. They're like basic practices of like running a team that are coming together. It's very cooperative, and we're all motivated by the mission we're on, and we're all working on open source code. But at the end of the day, I think at the core of the community that you're trying to build, you need to have a very healthy organization, and that looks a lot more like a microeconomic organization that we know from the traditional context. I know that's sort of I think not what a lot of people when they first enter DAO land want to believe or are being told, but I do believe that the most effective organizations in this space at the core will look a lot like that. Now, the superpower of the internet is that you can have these fat tails. Like, you can have people that You know, maybe they want to contribute 2 hours a week, and there's a particular task that they have or a particular project that they oversee that it gives them that level of flexibility. And that's really amazing. But generally, I think we can carry a lot of those lessons over. Human nature hasn't changed that much over the last couple thousand years.
That's right. That's right. We just keep on questioning that premise over and over again. What's overlooked in discussions about decentralized science beyond perhaps the myth of like the individual just like being able to independently accomplish like great complex things? What issues or questions do you wish got more attention?
Well, I think the one controversial or non-narrative take that LabDAO represents in what you could say is DeSci right now is the idea that you can actually organically create value in an online community. And so a lot of the projects we're seeing, they are taking a sort of funding approach. So the work is happening outside of the internet in a physical realm where like a human organization is already existing. There's a human team, there's a project that is existing offline, and the funding and the decision-making is happening on online, but the work is happening sort of off-chain. What we're really interested in is building the tools that make that creation game actually also happen on-chain. That's a way longer, far shot than sort of quote-unquote just funding science that's already happening in a traditional context, and that's why not a lot of people are doing it, but that's something that we fundamentally believe in, and we're sort of going at great lengths to make it possible.
Yeah. And you touched upon this in multiple answers, but I'd like to ask it explicitly nonetheless. Why would a researcher actually come to LabDAO rather than, say, traditional institutions for like tools and funding? Why not just stay in academia? I think this is a good segue to talk about like differences in like the private and public sector in general.
Right. So realistically, I don't believe that we will have full-time LabDAO scientist in the near future. And this is actually nothing too controversial when you look at how most DAOs work. Like in most DAOs, people have other jobs and it's more of a club, it's a membership, it's a cooperative. I would even say that we are probably almost exotic to the point that we have actually a serious team of 5 people that are full-time and are working every day on building code, and there's a product manager, user experience team. This is, I think, somewhat untypical for how DAOs operate. So I don't think we're going to be seeing completely full-time scientists that are only networked in the next couple of years. That said, obviously, one day I will want to be at that point. So I think the way that we can think about LabDAO in the next couple of years, it's like a membership. It's like a club that you're a part of. You're an enthusiast in Web3 and you're a scientist and you want to be part of this. And by the way, this community is maintaining an open source client that makes it very easy to run tools for computational biology and gives you access to physical laboratory resources. And then obviously when you want to use them, and you have a lot of capital demand to run them, and you know, perhaps you're not affiliated with an organization, then obviously there's this whole idea of investing in projects and funding them. And that's where we would then partner with the right folks that are specialized in that domain.
Okay. So since you've worked both within academia and within the startup context, or even, you know, Web3 context, what are some common misunderstandings that, say, the two factions like have of each other? What do you wish each side would realize about the other's world?
Oh, that's a good one. To be honest, I don't, I'm now a bit more than 1 year into building something new, and I spent a couple more years in academia, so I think I can probably make more qualified comments around what academics should think and how academia works rather than how startups work. I'm figuring that one out every day right now.
Sure, yeah, we can just take one side.
But when we think about academia and we look into startup land from the academic lens, I think I think what a lot of academics might criticize around the private sector is that people in the private sector seem to be way more focused. It's like you're not running multiple projects, and you have very little time to go back and ask those really big questions. And I think in academia, at least from my point of view, I always felt that that was the weakness of the markets, of the private sector. But now being on the other side of that sort of fence, actually, I find it extremely liberating in a way, because once you've, I think when you don't know what you want to do, you should stay in academia, or you should stay in a space that allows you to do five projects and explore different ideas. But the moment that there is a thing that gets you out of bed every day of the week, that makes you not fall asleep because you're so excited about it, you should leave academia right now. And you should, especially when you have an idea how you can turn that into something that is financially sustainable. So The private sector allows you to focus on one thing. And when you can focus and when you don't want to focus, it's not the right place. But if you want to focus and you want to dedicate yourself to one thing, it's the best place. I think that's sort of that's something I learned over the last couple of months, and when I contrast that to the attitude I had while I was still in academia.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, at least if it's like pragmatic kind of research that can be turned into a product, instead of like having a class kind of theoretical stuff that might make you very focused on, you know, like a particular set of inquiries like throughout your lifetime, but that can never like really be turned into like theoretical physics, for example. It's probably harder to like actually, if you're like in some esoteric branch or like say math, to actually turn that into a product ever. But I feel like in the life sciences in particular, it's kind of like mapping inquiries into products seems much more attainable.
Yeah, although you could say that even in some more abstract branches of science, I think one would be surprised to, like, in retrospect, look back and say, well, they started with this very abstract idea and then it turned into something very tangible with enough time. So Demis Hassabis at DeepMind, like, they were really, from what I've read, they were really debating whether they should launch a company or whether they should try to raise a big grant to do the type of research that they wanted to do. And they pulled it off to build a company that in the first couple months, years, like, they trained neural networks to play video games. That's a hard sell, but the markets are great in the way that they can identify people that are passionate for what they do, and they can listen to the stories that these people tell about how this could eventually lead to something that's commercially viable. And even if it's just such a long shot, markets give these teams sometimes opportunities to work on what they want to work on, and then, you know, once in a while, people that believe in these teams also really get rewarded. So I think there are fewer scientific areas than one might think that are not amenable to have very focused founders emerge out of them.
So to stay within academia, are there any like apparently burdensome processes that exist within academia that you think actually serve a valuable purpose? Maybe another way to ask this question would be like, what aspects of academia are often like criticized, especially perhaps with people that you're working around now, kind of more in Web3, that are criticized, but only because their true role isn't correctly understood by people that you work around now in the private industry?
I think students. So I spent most of my experience with academia in the role of the student, but towards the end, I also had a couple students, and you need to know, I think, when you work with a student, that most of the time you're donating some of your attention and you're donating some of your time, and that person learns through you. And when you're lucky, there's something that sort of productive that comes out of it. But when I think you do it right, it's extremely enriching, and you can work with some of the brightest young people in the world when you're in academia. Well, once you're in the private markets, you're interacting with other folks that are in the private markets, and these people that they usually like know they're right, and you just don't get to like spend time and work with like all these brilliant young folks that want to work with you for you. It's a different dynamic, and I think working with students is something that's generally underestimated in academia, and that like it's absolutely required. Like the moment that I think you don't spend time with students in academia, things start to get a bit weird, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Is that also like having students, did that change you fundamentally, you would say? Like even in what you do now, do you feel like you have gotten better because you actually had to mentor people, like really learn to explain concepts to them? I could see like maybe there's some transfer of skills that could even serve you right now.
Yeah, totally. I think the first Kanban boards I ever drew was while I was like mentoring students in academia, and like the first daily stand-up happened while I was in academia. So that both at the German Cancer Research Center and at the Broad Institute. And actually at the Broad, we even had a group that was called Agile in Academia. So we were seriously looking at like how do like some teams in tech organize themselves, and what can we carry over into academic work. So that was a pretty good testing ground, especially when you're young and you still have a lot to learn to get started.
Yeah. Is there anything between you and the people that you work with that you often disagree about regarding how to run LabDAO or even how to improve research in the computational life sciences more broadly?
I don't think I fundamentally disagree with a paradigm that's currently existing, but I do believe that there are some things that might be a bit less obvious to folks right now that I believe are becoming very obvious, especially recently. Do you know this idea from natural language, like machine learning, of like a chain of thought reasoning, where if you formulate a chain of thoughts, So when humans think, when we tackle a difficult problem, we usually break that problem down in order to solve it. So when I give you the question, what is the square root of the age at which Napoleon died, you would not try to solve that problem all in one go. You would break it down into multiple intermediate steps that would probably involve like asking Google for how old Napoleon was when he died before you calculate the square root. People can use large language models to do the same, and if they do, these models, these setups perform way better than if you forced the model to do that in one go. And I think science generally is oftentimes a chain of thought where scientists, they integrate various observations or different papers, they have chains of reasonings, and then they have a prompt basically that they send to nature where they design an experiment to and see what comes out to learn something new. So I think there's a lot of reasoning where the sort of chain of thought analog applies to science. Now, that's one thing. So chain of thought. I think there is another thing that is very related, which is chain of tools. When you're in the lab and you're actually running an experiment, most of the time you're not designing all the equipment from scratch for this particular experiment. No, you're working with the tools that are available to you. And if you don't have access to a tool, you might ask the lab next door, hey, can you borrow me your tool? And you design a protocol, you design a chain of tools to collect new information about the nature of reality. And I believe that in the future, we will have a lot of tools that help us build chains of tools where we say, take this information, run it through this tool, then to the next tool, and then show me the result. And that's a paradigm that we think about a lot when we design Plex.
Yeah. How does tacit knowledge then play into that? Because I'm sure like it's very hard to actually make explicit a lot of like the knowledge that would become integrated into these chain of tools. just because you need maybe like lab work experience to do that, or like a particular professor is just like kind of learn it by trial and error. How do you think about kind of the limits of those more explicit chains, just because of the nature of some knowledge that remains tacit?
So that, I think that's going to be the competitive advantage of different scientists, right? If you have gathered experience in one particular domain, you're going to have more tacit knowledge with regards to all the tools in that domain. You're going to be able to design better experiments or interpret data in a more intelligent way. That said, we try right now quite a bit to incorporate at least some basic tacit knowledge into every tool that we abstract within within LabDAO, within the team. So just an example, we oftentimes you can gather some information from the papers. So one example is we have a tool that is called CollabFold that's been developed by Martin Steinegger in Singapore. And that's basically a very fast version of AlphaFold, you could say, or a lightweight version of AlphaFold. Mm-hmm. So it requires less storage and great resource. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some lessons that people have shared on social media and other sources of how you could configure this tool to get certain predictions that were not in the official an official manual from the paper. And we implement these configurations into Plex. So you can, when you have a certain idea, you can run the tool already in a recommended configuration. So, wisely designed defaults capture some tacit knowledge and reduce the load of tacit knowledge that's required to use a tool.
Okay, yeah. And perhaps to stay on the tacit knowledge front, what is the kind of implicit knowledge in your field that you feel holds true generally, but it isn't necessarily yet explicitly stated? Especially perhaps say in the centralized science, what has to be learned anew through experience by everyone entering with no real reason, could be written down, shared more publicly.
That's an interesting question. So just restating, what is the tacit knowledge of building in the centralized science?
Yes.
I think
like,
personally,
what do you feel like is unnecessarily tacit to, if there's any such thing?
I think unnecessarily tacit. I think one of the most powerful ideas of Web3 is distributed storage. You know, we all think about if you're in virtual machine and moving assets and having smart contracts that handle the transfer of these assets or tokens. And I think a lot of people underestimate the power of content addressed data. And I think that idea is so powerful that you could build extremely impactful tools just by focusing on content addressed data and not thinking about tokens at all. And I think tokens sometimes they even keep out some great scientists or great engineers that would otherwise be already building some really useful stuff on these distributed data storage systems. And yeah, obviously talking a bit of my own book here, I'm personally really excited about this piece and we're building pretty avidly on it.
Yeah, yeah. What got you hooked realizing this then when it maybe wasn't like kind of like mainstream knowledge around you?
So this is a bit of a personal story. Right after finishing medical school, and for a couple of months, I was working also as a postdoc, because that's what they call you when you're not in school anymore, and you're still finishing your work. And while I was finishing that paper, I had to rerun some analyses that I had last run before I spent some time in the States pre-COVID. Now, this is not a lot of fun, trying to rerun a pipeline and hundreds of lines of code and hoping that it runs just the same way than the last time that you ran it 3 years ago. And that experience of not knowing exactly where the data is because there was a migration of the server and having to rerun code that you really just could knock on wood and hope that it would run like you expect it to run. That experience was so so intense that I just decided that I would not want, not something needed to happen. I don't want to work on scientific projects anymore where I'm the only one in the team of scientists that cares about reproducible computational workflows, best practices of storing the data and making sure it's accessible by everyone. I just don't want to work in it, like in a context where that is something that people take for granted. And this idea of, hey, there is this hash, there's a string of letters and numbers. And when I know this hash, it doesn't matter on what server that file is located, I can always access it. That idea is so powerful that once you read up on it, you feel like you need to drop everything else you're doing when you're thinking about making science more reproducible. And that's really what happened to me. I just got really hooked on this new tech, that came out around distributed storage, and thought, okay, you know, there's all this coin stuff happening, but this is actually the real or one of the most significant step changes that a lot of people, I think, are at least in academia are not aware of right now. Not to discount tokens, I think that's also all so important in its own right, but I think the storage is something that's just generally underestimated.
So if you had double the amount of current funding right now for LabDAO, which direction would you take it into? Would you introduce totally new features, or just you know, in quotations, do a scaled up version of the same work? Or perhaps that's not even the right dichotomy, because scaled up efforts would actually enable you to do totally new things. But however you want to answer that.
Right now, I'm extremely excited about what we're building with Plex, which is enables you to run computational tools on Bacala, which is a distributed compute framework in IPFS. And if I had more funding, I would just build an even bigger team to keep working on that. No other idea, I think, is currently that comes close to that.
Yeah, sweet. And what have you personally become most skeptical about in the past, I don't know, like 5 years, say? What have you become more convinced of recently?
What have I become more convinced of?
And skeptical. You can give both or just one, whatever comes to mind.
Yeah, I think this is a bit of an Ayn Randian answer, but I've become more skeptical of people that say they act in the public's best interest. So, and I've become...
Were there any particular events that evoked that for you?
No particular event, but I think we've all been involved in the sort of the new cycle over the last years. It starts with certain scientific media coverage. It ends with regulation around financial markets and Web3. So that's one thing. The one thing I've gotten a bit more convinced over is that good governance matters, and you can find really good governance both in the public and in the private sector. And I think a lot of academics believe that, you know, the sort of level-headed, thoughtful style of leadership and governance is usually only found in the public sector. And I was very wrong. The best people in the private sector, or like in Web3, the most like impressive teams, they're all just extremely level-headed, smart, hardworking, rational, great folks. And that's something that I think within academia, you sometimes believe that only the public sector attracts these folks, but Web3 attracts a subset of these people as well. That's something I think I've gotten way more optimistic on. You can find great people in various disciplines.
Yeah. And so what do you think right now are the most important efforts in decentralized science? What's holding things back? What should people actually look toward more, fund more of?
I think we're not talking enough about the infrastructure and funding mechanisms that can interface with the public sector and the existing science funding stack and the existing science infrastructure stack. And that's very understandable, right? First, you want to build your own thing before you then tell the rest of the world about how they can sort of come to you or like build the bridge. I hope that we can get to a point in the next 2 years where more and more of the projects that are in this space start to have constructive conversations with the existing institutions and existing scientists and change what they're building or communicate it more effectively so that this can become a solution for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So lastly, can you think of any important questions that I've not asked you today? Is there anything left unaddressed that you really care about or want to mention before we go?
This is a really good one. I think you haven't really asked me a lot about what you can do right now with what we're building at LabDAO. And maybe I can just briefly speak about
it. It was very
that.
Meta.
which I think is great. Like, I really enjoyed it.
I can get more concrete now.
Well, at least I'm just gonna give a quick summary. I think when you're a scientist and you're listening to this conversation, and you have listened to this conversation for now an hour, and you're still trying to figure out, okay, what is decentralized science? What is this all about? I would just invite you to head to our docs.labdao.xyz, and you will learn a lot about Plex, the tool we're building, and that tool allows you today to basically run Docker containers that for protein folding and small molecule docking on distributed compute. And you can basically, from your laptop, without having a GPU, you can run some of these machine learning workflows pretty directly and work with the result. And over the next couple of months, we're going to be onboarding more and more tools. And we'd love to hear feedback and get in touch if you like what you're seeing and you want to learn more.
All right, exciting stuff. Nicholas, thanks so much for talking today. We'll link everything, including the docs that you mentioned, in the show notes. And thanks again for talking.
Thank you so much for having me.